So today we'll talk about the story of Har HaMelech. Three stories of Churban that were introduced because of overconfidence, lack of precaution, lack of reading the room, as we say, reading the temperature properly. One was, of course, Kamsa Bar Kamsa, which we all know. Two people failed to read the room. One was the host who kicked out the unintended guest, and the other person was Sechai Ben Afkilos, who didn't realize this was a time to be Mekil on the Churban rather than to be stiff and unrelenting, and therefore when the Caesar sent the animal with a slight mum, he should have brought the carbon or should have. So the second story is Har HaMelech. Let me tell you the story, and then I'll highlight some of the features of the story that Chazal intend us to understand better. So the story is as follows. In this place called Har HaMelech, which was it's like a metropolis, and many, you'll see millions of Jews live there in the second Beis HaMikdash. Har HaMelech is called Tor Malka. Tor in Aramaic is Har, Malka, Har HaMelech. So they had a minhag when the Chasen Kala would celebrate. They would have a male chicken and a female chicken run in front of the celebration, run in front of the procession. And this was a sign for Purim, because chickens are very fruitful, very productive. At one point, they were having a Chasen Kala celebration, and the Roman army, right? The Roman army wasn't just there battling the Jews. The Roman army was stationed there. Some of them had battle. Some of these things relented. So the Roman soldiers happened to be there. They weren't at war at that point. There was some cessation. We don't really know when this happened in the overall Roman-Jewish experience. But the Romans took the chickens, right? When you're soldiers, you're very hungry. So you can have supply lines to deliver food and grains, but it's very hard to have meats and poultry, right? Because it's harder to transport livestock all the way from Rome to Israel. So you try to eat off of the local opportunities, the local livestock. But you know, people aren't going to freely offer. So these Romans, they just saw two chickens running around in the street. There's nothing criminal. I mean, they should have asked who the chickens were. But this wasn't an act of aggression. It's not like the Romans did anything terrible. They didn't kill anyone. They just saw two chickens. They ate the chickens. All of a sudden, the Jews jumped them. You know, all the Jewish people were so angry. They took these two chickens, and they jumped on the Romans, and they tuned them up a little bit. The Jewish mob, you know, attack the Romans, the Roman soldiers. So at some point, word gets back to the Caesar, and the Caesar says, okay, this is something we have to go to battle about because you offended the dignity of my soldiers. Now, what happened was the Jewish people had this soldier called Bar Daroma, and he came from the south, Bar Daroma, a man from the south, and he was able to leap an entire mile at once, like the Flash, and move around the Roman groups and just kill whoever he wanted to. So he was like the super warrior, the super predator, and the Romans had no way to defeat him. So the Caesar realized that he was going to lose. So he put his crown on the ground and he said, "Kodesh Baruch Hu, Davent Hashem, if you want me to lose, then I'll just accept my fate," something to that nature. Anyway, this Bar Daroma had a bad fate because he was a little bit too arrogant. We'll see his arrogance later. And he was killed in the bathroom when a snake, you know, came out of the ground and disemboweled him and ate his insides. Anyway, so at this point, even though Bar Daroma has been taken out of the picture, he's been sidelined, he's dead. We don't really know when he died. Did he die during the war, after? It's hard to know the chronology of these stories. But basically, the Roman general decides he's not going to battle the Jews because he's too afraid either of Bar Daroma or because he feels that he's going to lose the battle. He sees a sign from heaven. In any event, what happens is he decides to declare an armistice, to declare peace. And at that point, the celebration that breaks out in Hartura. Everyone starts celebrating, and they start lighting candles, and you can see this mountain with millions of Jews living there, literally, as I'll say, millions of Jews, and you can see all the lights that they lit up from afar. There's a big celebration. So now, all of a sudden, the Roman general hasn't really left yet, saying, "Wait a second, they're celebrating. We just made an armistice. They shouldn't be celebrating." So then he launches an attack, and essentially, he defeats Hartura, and he massacres Hartura. Yeah, that's the storyline. That's the frame or the skeleton of the story. What do Chazal want us to see? Okay, so first of all, why are we interested in this Bar Daroma, who was able to leap a mile at a time and kill Roman soldiers? Evidently, we're still seeing the effects of living in Israel under supernatural conditions. Namely, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Hashgach is in Eretz Yisrael. Simply living in Eretz Yisrael means you're going to be a Bar Daroma, you're going to be a strong person, you're going to be a great military warrior. In fact, interestingly enough, modern archaeology suggests that the average size and height of a Jewish person living in Israel was taller even than the Romans. Namely, the average Jewish warrior was stronger and more fit than his counterpart. You really think these Roman gladiators, they're invincible, they're bully, and they can't be. Because living in Israel, even at that late stage of history, remember this is the end of the second Beis HaMikdash, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence is in Eretz Israel, even when Hashem's presence isn't fully in Eretz Israel. All this talk we had last week in Parshas Devarim about the giants who lived in Israel, and the giants who lived here, and the giants who lived there, and the giants in Bereishis. There are no giants living in Iceland. There are no giants living in, who knows where, in Germany, Bavaria. Because living under the presence of Hashem in this land, eating the food of Eretz Israel, when it's supernatural food, when it's superfood like the Meraglim, the food that the Meraglim brought back, is going to lead to stronger people, more healthier people, and in this case, this superhero called Bar Daroma, who could jump a mile and kill Roman soldiers. So you're seeing, even at this late stage, in fact, we have stories of Chazal in the end of Ksuas, even after the Churban, finding fruits that were ginormous and extravagantly sized, because, of course, once the Shechina left Eretz Yisrael, at a certain point, Eretz Yisrael became arid and fallow. The same type of thing you have with Har HaMelech. I'm not going to bore you with the details, but Chazal's description of Har HaMelech, literally, tens of millions of Jews were living there. Now, was this just an exaggeration? Yeah, but not by much. Because there's a part of the story, now I'm filling in some of the blanks, where Stuckey then heard the story, like learned it at some point, and said, oh, come on, these Chazal, just like they engineer Psukim in the Torah, all these myths in the Torah that we don't accept, all these drashos. So the Stuckey came and he said to Rabbi Chanina, Shikuri b'shakrasalei. These rabbis, they're lying. How could there be close to a million people on this mountain in the middle of Israel? And he answered him, Chanin answered the Tzuki, Eretz Tzvi, that Israel is like a deer. A deer's skin expands and contracts based on how large the deer grows. If there's a lot of flesh, then the skin expands. If there's little flesh, it can less flesh, then it contracts. So Eretz Yisrael is called Eretz Tzvi because it expands and contracts to hold the Jewish people. And maybe during periods of Golos, Eretz Yisrael shrunk because the Jews weren't there and no other nations could colonize the land. But now that we're back, we see how many Jews can live in Eretz Yisrael. Now again, were some of these numbers inflated? Maybe. But they were really large numbers, and the really large numbers, again, indicated the supernatural size of Eretz Yisrael, supernatural experience of being in Eretz Yisrael. So these are two highlights of the story. You see a person with superpowers, and you see a land that's able to, a mountain that's able to contain billions of people. Now, the problem is that when you're too successful for your own good, certain things start to happen, and that you also see in the story. There were three different cities on this mountain that were major, major areas where the Jews lived. One was called Kfar Bish, one was called Kfar Shachalayim, and one was called Kfar Dachra. Okay? So Kfar Bish, Kfar Shachalayim was the easy part. They made their living by producing a type of vegetable. A very expensive vegetable, Kfar Shachalayim. Why was one of the cities called Kfar Bish? Because they would never offer hospitality to visitors. They're like stone. Now, why don't you offer hospitality to visitors? Such terrible people? No. Because we have so much, you don't need to be dependent on one another. Think, for example, the difference between living in Alon Shavuot and living in, let's say, Beitar, or living in Ramat Beit Shemesh Gimel, in a really deep Haredi or Bnei Brak. Here, in Alon Shavuot, more or less, most people, Baruch Hashem, are self-sufficient, Baruch Hashem are financially solvent. If you need something, you go to the store and buy it. Okay, you're not going to buy it. I don't live extravagantly, but I need something, I go to the store and buy it. If you live in Ramat Beit Shemesh Gimel, or if you live in Bnei Brak, you don't have enough funds. So you should see the size of the gemach books in these neighborhoods. You have a gemach for everything. A gemach for food, a gemach for fridges, a gemach for cars, a gemach for toothpicks, a gemach for bobby pins, a gemach for services, a gemach for goods. Because you have to create an economy that exists on bartering goods and services, because you don't have enough. You can't afford to pay for the goods and services yourself. So there are pros and cons of each style of living. But one of the pros is when you live in Ramat Beit Shemesh Gimel, when you live in whatever, you're living in a state of dependency. You know that you have to live with other people, and you have to give and get, because you can't have everything you need by yourself. And when you live too comfortably and you have too much, not rich, not indulgent, not luxurious, not hedonistic, but just you have everything you need, it's hard for you to break through and act out of the box and give chesed and create a community of chesed. So it's a struggle in life to hit that sweet spot between being able to support your family and creating a community that's financially solvent, but still creating room for chesed, room for acts of charity. And evidently they lost it because they had so much. And so many people living there, and so much largesse, and so much success, that they created a city called Kfar Bish, which was stone-like. They weren't terrible. They weren't immoral. They were just too comfortable. The second city that's described there, same thing, is Kfar Dachra. So one was Kfar Shechalayim, city of Shechalayim. One was the city of Bish. And one was Kfar Dachria. What was Kfar Dachria? Because they had two children. And no more. Sound familiar? Most of the modern world today is struggling to hit, I forget the name of it, there's a certain term, the reproductive rate. You need to have each family, I think it's 2.1 children or something, in order to regenerate the next generation. And most of the Western world is beneath that rate. Namely, they don't have 2.1, or I think somewhere between 2 and 3. They don't have enough children to regenerate the next generation. Again, because it's an ethos, it's a culture. If you have too much, you start to become self-indulgent and interested in your own comfort and your own. Right? One of the basic differences between the Jewish approach and Western civilization approach is, how do you see your years between 25 and 50? Those are your prime years, your prime health, your prime earning capacity, your prime, the prime of your life, 25 to 50 to whatever. How do you see those years? So in Western civilization, the basic ethos is enjoy those years. Get a little something for yourself. Again, not in a bad way, not an extravagant way. That's time to live, to travel, to earn money, to enjoy, to buy nice cars. And in our society, it's, okay, that's the time to build the next generation. You know how much money we spend on education, and chinuch, and investing massively in children, investing massively. People always ask me, how many children should I have in my family? That's a very, very easy question to answer. And it's a very hard question to answer. So I'll give you the answer that applies to every single person alive, every single Jew alive. How many children should you have? As many as you possibly can. Now, the end of that sentence is a very, very complicated phrase. As many as you possibly can. Financial capacity, psychological capacity, physical capacity, marital capacity. There are many factors that go into having a big family. You know, your body can't handle it, your marriage can't handle it, your psychology can't handle it, your finances. But the goal is as many as you can. Not to limit, but to expand. Every person you bring into this world is olam umlo. You're building a whole world. Okay, you have certain limits on what you can do. So here you have literally Western Europe in the middle of Kfar Bacha. One child, one boy and one girl, to be yotze the mitzvah, to have a nice, simple family. I'm assuming they had one goldfish and one dog also. You know, everyone had. And it was a selfishness that was bred on too much comfort. So you see, on the one hand, there's great largesse. And that people like Bar de Roma, the Flash, who could run a mile a minute and kill Roman soldiers before they knew what was happening to them. And you had this mountain that had millions of people, but it was too comfortable. There's too much. Okay, let's move a little forward. There's a lot to talk about. Try to be as brief as possible. Now, what was their undoing? What was their failure? So one is, they acted silly. Yeah, you're right, they stole your chickens, but you have to learn where to draw the line, where to pick your fights. So they took the chickens. Big deal. Okay. Oh, it was part of the wedding ceremony. They didn't take the ring, they didn't take the ksuvah. The wedding ceremony was halachic. They just invaded the smorgasbord. They took some of the chickens. You have to know when to compromise in life, what to give into, and not to get all caught up in this confrontationalism, where anything, which unfortunately we live in today's world. In today's world, we live in such a politically divided and polarized world that anything that the right says, the left disagrees with reflexively. Anything the left says, the right disagrees with. Rather than thinking, okay, these are important issues, these are core issues, this is what we believe in. If the left were to decide to, pass the bill that everyone should wear a white shirt or whatever, the right would say, okay, I want to pass the bill, everyone should wear a black shirt. It's called bedafkinik. Trying to make a statement. Okay, these are the Romans. These are our enemies. How dare they take the chicken? They took chickens. You have millions of people living on the mountain. I'm sure you find other chickens. They ruined the ceremony. And all of a sudden, this whole tragedy with millions of people being killed was caused because of two chickens, which is what it says. That's sad. That's infantile. Give them the chickens. And then later, second mistake. Finally, there's an abatement in the hostilities, and you have a little bit of peace, and you can recover, and who knows, maybe sign a long-term peace treaty. And all of a sudden, you start celebrating with bands and music and big lights. Just not everything you feel has to be expressed in grandiose terms. Maybe kiddush in the morning, some gefilte fish, and some whiskey the next day. Mecha l'chaim, we defeated the Romans. But big, grand celebrations, trying to make a point, make a statement. Obviously, we're making a statement, right? we beat the Romans, we're celebrating. Have to learn about tznius, not just on a personal level, but a communal level. Okay? What we do celebrate, what we don't. Do we rub people's noses in the sand? Do you not rub? And here you see two fatal flaws. Number one, stupidity, infantilism. You're fighting over chickens. Oh, they invaded my wedding ceremony. Okay, move on. The second issue is you finally reach, right? You have to be a little bit guarded and cautious. And okay, it's we're here in Eretz Yisrael, Baruch Hashem, but, you know, not everything is so certain and sure. All these loud celebrations and, you know, especially in Rav Amital felt that very powerfully in the wake of the Holocaust, you know, very vulnerable, and who knows how long we're able to maintain this country and just... Okay, now we're in a triumphant stage, Baruch Hashem. Over the last couple of days have been very, very painful. So, just a little bit understatedness on a personal level and on a communal level. The final issue that I'll talk about is, you see the Roman general talking to Hashem. Again, remember we talked about some of the Roman generals were defiant, Titus. Here you have a Roman general who, seeing Bar de Roma's impact on his army, places his crown on the ground. Again, I'll read you the language that he says. And he... where is it here? Okay, he put his crown on the ground, and he said, "Rabbanu Shalom, if you want to take the crown from me, at least don't give me to Bar de Roma. Just decide some other way to defeat me." And then Bar de Roma gets killed at some point. But this Roman general sees this as a sign from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he shouldn't, at least in the initial stages, attack Artura, and he withholds until he sees a big, loud celebration. So again, you're starting to see at this stage of history. Some of these Roman generals are like the old Nimrods, Titus, and they're defying as Hashem. Some of them are discovering Hashem. And the Neron case, I remember we talked about Neron a couple of weeks ago, when he shot the arrows and he saw the land of Yerushalayim. And he saw that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, wanted him to be the bad guy, to destroy Yerushalayim. He said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm not going to do your dirty work. Get someone else. If I see that, you know, you want me to be your messenger of evil and your devil, I'm not going to do that. I'd rather be an angel. I'd rather be a malach. So he becomes a ger, and someone else takes over. So you see, this is an interesting period in history where humanity is starting to discover Hashem, even the Romans. Okay, tomorrow is our last day. If you're here for Vatikin, and Mirtz Hashem, we'll have a shift.